Hello, this is Scott Gillespie, and welcome to the fourth season of Plants Dig Soil. In this podcast, you'll learn how to think critically about regenerative agriculture claims so that you can apply proven and profitable practices that benefit your farm now and in the future. Creating this podcast helps me to clarify my thinking. I do a lot of reading, but I find that until I get things down in writing, it's all just ideas that are floating around in my head. I'm often surprised when I come back to older material that I find that I've forgotten about things that I'd already discovered. This past season covered a lot of topics that are pertinent to agriculture right now and that have been stewing in my mind for a while. At the end of each season, I like to do a review episode to wrap things up. It's also a good starting point for anyone coming in later to get up to speed on what I've covered each season. When this season began, most of the prairies were stuck in a drought. My area, in southern Alberta, Canada, was coming off a multi-year drought and had very little winter precipitation. All around us, things were changing, but we stayed dry. There were areas that quickly became too wet to seed. Further east, there were areas that had floodwaters covering over their land. In June, we finally started seeing some rain. It was just enough to keep the crop going, and then we went right back to hot and dry. It was in this context that I released the first two episodes on fertilizer planning and cover crops. At the time, fertilizer was at historically high prices and was hard to find. In the podcast, I argued that of any time that soil testing would pay off, this was the year. Knowing what you had in the soil could help you allocate the proper resources to the proper field. A key concept in this episode was to look at nutrient flows in historical contexts to aid your decision. Phosphorus gets rapidly tied up in the soil and slowly releases over the years. What the plant takes up this year is usually only 1/5 to 1/3 of what you apply. The rest is made up of a combination of what you have applied over the past 5 to 10 years. This is known as legacy phosphorus. If you've been building your soil over time, you had the option this year of mining the soil. A small amount down with the crop to help early season growth would likely be enough if your test was in the low to medium range. You can do this for a year or two, but eventually you need to overapply, preferably when fertilizer prices are low, to build up the soil levels again. In the second episode, I talked about cover crops and how they fit into a drought cycle. The key concept that I was going for in this episode is that you need to look at your overall water cycle to decide. If you just barely have enough water to make a cash crop, don't go trying to grow a cover crop. If you don't think you have enough water to grow a cash crop, consider taking a fallow year. Fallow has got a bad rap in the past few decades because, when done poorly, it can leave the soil in worse shape. Too much tillage to control the weeds can lead to erosion. Herbicides used too much lead to resistant weeds. The evaporation of soil moisture can wick up salts to the surface. And, worst of all, the microbes are starved and they burn up organic matter for energy. In the short term, this will leave nutrients for the following cash crop, but it slowly degrades the nutrient and water-holding capacity of the soil. In this episode, I argue that a well-timed, short-term cover crop can make this fallow period pay more than just leaving the ground bare, or trying and failing to grow a cash crop. The cover crop can suppress weeds, limit the salts from rising by running the water through the plant, and it can feed the microbes to prevent the loss of organic matter. As long as the amount of water used is less than what would normally be evaporated, and the cost of seed is no less than normal tillage or herbicides, it's a win. If you're in the province of Alberta, you've probably heard about new funding that can help pay for cover crops, soil testing, manure, compost, and digest, hauling and application, split applied nitrogen, nitrogen inhibitors, and getting set up for rotational grazing. As you can tell from these episodes and from the many seasons of this podcast, I'm well qualified to help you with this. This funding is part of a national on-farm climate action fund. You need a PAG, or a professional agrologist, or a CCA, which is a certified crop advisor, on the application, and I have both designations. This funding covers my fees for helping you make and implement the plans, So if you've been on the fence about engaging me in consulting services, there's no better time to start. If we make the application before November of 2022, we can get everything you did this year on the application. For 2023, we can make the plans over the winter and get the application in as soon as they open the portal in February. Get a hold of me today by checking the episode description or listening to the end for ways to contact me. Shifting now to the middle of the podcast season, I tackled intercropping. This is a practice where you grow two or more crops at the same time. The idea is that a monoculture will always leave some resources behind, and so by adding diversity, you should get more total bushels off the land than if you just planted one crop on half the field and one crop on the other half. Where I see this working is where there are obvious advantages. For example, in a pea and mustard intercrop, the mustard can give the peas a trellis to climb up and stay off the ground. The mustard may also help induce more nitrogen fixation in the peas by quickly taking up all that's there and is freely available. Something interesting that I learned after the podcast on Twitter is that some studies are showing that the non-legume plant may be taking advantage of the legume. I learned that the nodules are leaky and they let some of the nitrogen go before the legume can take it up. When grown as a monoculture, the legume roots are there, ready to pick up the losses. In an intercrop, the non-legume has the possibility of being quicker to grab it. There's new evidence that the non-legume may be releasing signaling molecules to upregulate the legume to make more nitrogen than it normally would. Now, if this is a symbiotic relationship, it may be paying the legume carbon through mycorrhizal networks. If it's tricking the legume and stealing the nitrogen by having its roots ready to capture the leaky nitrogen before the legume can, it sounds a little more sinister. It was not clear what the mechanism was, just that it was doing this. Over the course of the next two episodes, I argued that it might be better to think of intercrop cover crops rather than intercrop cash crops. By focusing on cover crops, you don't need to worry about getting the right mix at seeding time. You don't need to worry about mismatched maturities. And you don't need to separate seeds at harvest. I also talked about an often overlooked component of intercropping cash crops. The lure of it is that you're getting more off the land than growing a single crop. If you're over-yielding, that is, getting more total bushels off the land in a mix, rather than separate monocultures, you're exporting more nutrients off the land. By intercropping cover crops, you still get your cash crop, but you also work at building the soil. In a drought year, you may not plant another crop. In a wet year, you may interseed a cover crop once the cash crop is well established. If the summer turns hot and dry, the cash crop wins. If it's a wet summer, you get a soil-building crop that continues well into the fall after harvest of the cash crop. This practice is not new. It's been used by indigenous for centuries in what is known as the Three Sisters: corn, beans, and squash. Where it differs from our modern system is that it's all done by hand and cannot be easily mechanized. Each crop has different harvest times. What was new to me as I learned about this system is that it wasn't just fields of these crops growing together. It was the food crops, but it was also medicinal plants and what were called mother plants. We'd call them cover crops. They were plants that were observed to help the food and medicinal crops to grow better, and so were left in place. Often overlooked in indigenous practices is that fields were not what we imagine fields to be. There were always natural areas nearby. These areas supported insects, birds, and animals that provided pest control and what we might call ecosystem services. I explored this more in the fifth episode, where I looked beyond the field. Natural areas are being discussed more in the public domain now, but they're not a new idea. Some research shows that we need 30% of our land in natural areas to get the best pest protection for our crops. Since predators only move 100 meters or so, we need strips through the field for the best benefit. And I know this isn't going to happen, as we're set up for large fields, and unless society pays for it, we cannot take that amount of land out of production. However, we can look to converting marginal areas to natural areas. It doesn't even have to be non-agricultural. Forages can be established as it will grow better on the land than our annual crops. You may not have a use for it, and that's fine. It's still better than putting money into annual crops and not getting more than you put into it. Or worse yet, putting more into it than you get out. In drought years, you may find neighbors willing to pay for the forages there. In wet years, you may find that these areas can more readily take up the excess rains and make the rest of the field more productive. In the final episode, I covered the bios: biochar, biologicals, and biomass. Many people see biochar as a new thing, but it is in fact an ancient indigenous product. It originates in the Amazon, where soils were found to be much more productive around villages compared to the surrounding forest. Human waste, food scraps, and the biochar from cooking all contributed to this. When wood or any organic substance is burned in the near or complete absence of oxygen, it makes a substance that can help the soil. This substance raises the pH, unlocking some of the nutrients. It is also covered in exchange sites, allowing for more nutrient holding capacity. When you have geologically old soils that have turned acidic, this can make a big difference. In geologically young soils that I work with and have high pHs, it may not do much. In some cases, it can make the soil less productive by tying up nutrients. It is very resistant to decomposition, so it can stick around for centuries. The modern interest is mostly in this aspect of it. It could be a useful product for carbon sequestration. Some studies have shown that it primes the system to store more carbon than normally would. However, there are other studies that show that it helps to rev up the underground microbes and let go of more carbon than if it weren't applied. This is good for the farmer, as there'll be more nutrients released, but it's not so good if you want carbon credits. Biologicals are products that add microbes that are beneficial to the system, add a product of a microbe for stimulating plants to do more than they normally would, or help to slow down pests that hurt your crop. There's huge promise for this, but so far, I haven't seen anything that consistently works. Product web pages and social media accounts usually show convincing pictures, testimonials, or trials where they clearly won. When putting them through third-party trials, I often see them doing nothing much most of the time, and only occasionally giving a big win. For biochar and biologicals, the real test to me is biomass. If they help to make more biomass of the cash crop or the cover crop, or they help to prevent its loss, they may have a place in your system. In the end, it's all about biomass. The more you have in your cash crop, the more crop you have to harvest. The more you have in your cover crop, the more good it does for the soil. Over the fall and winter time, I'll be taking some time off making new episodes for the podcast to work on some new projects. You may recall that last winter I released an online course on cover crops. I would like to work on some new courses. If you have some ideas on what you'd like me to work on, please send them my way. The online course has proven to be a great way for farmers from any region to learn something new and end up with an actionable plan at the end. If you like DIY, the do-it-yourself learning, like I do, this is an easy way to learn on your own. The office hours and the extra help sessions are great for anyone that wants some time with me to fine-tune the plans. However, many people found that it was nice to just be able to work on it from the office or from home when it suited them and not have to travel a day or days to a conference. Another project I want to work on is putting all the content of this podcast into a book form. As I've made this over the years, I've just written what made sense at the time. As I've looked back, I think there's a natural grouping of episodes that could form a book. Now you might say, why would I buy a book when I can get the podcast for free? It's a good question, and I think the answer is, if this is good for you, don't worry about the book. I love podcasts and listen to many of them without buying their books, supporting them on Patreon, or buying their programs. That's the deal with podcasts. We put the information out there for free, and listeners decide if that's good enough or if they want more. It's only expected that a small segment of the audience will go to the next level, and I've did that on podcasts that I love. To me, putting the podcast into a book isn't just about sending all the transcripts to a company and having them put them out there as is. With the eye of an editor, doing some updating, and adding some new content, I think it can all come together in a cohesive package. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening. While you've got your podcast app open, can you do me a favor? Ratings and reviews really help podcasts to reach new audiences. I have decided to keep my podcast free, so if you want to help me, there's no better way. While you're there, make sure you're subscribed so you see new episodes when they come out. If you prefer email, consider going to my website, www.plantsdigsoil.com, and click on the newsletter option. It comes out once a month with new episode listings, events that I'll be at, and carefully curated content with commentary so you can keep up with the essential news in regenerative agriculture. If you don't like email newsletters and are on Twitter or LinkedIn, consider checking out the newsletter option there. As opposed to posts, you'll always be notified of new ones, and I promise to only send something out once a month. I always like to know how people that give out information for free actually make money. The podcast is free so that you can learn something new and get to know how I work through issues. If you need a little more help than the podcast can provide, I am developing self-directed online courses to help you dive deeper into issues. Included in the courses are office hours that should let you have time with me to fine-tune your plans. Details are at my website, www.plantsdigsoil.com. And if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you'll get $20 off. When you need more than that, I provide consulting packages that can be used in person, online, or a combination of the two. Most people start with a Q&A session where I answer your top questions and we get to know each other better. Beyond that, we can move to a farm planning or annual retainer plan. If you live in southern Alberta, Canada, I can provide scouting services throughout the summer with weekly field checks for crop staging, pest presence, and under irrigated fields, soil moisture and weekly irrigation plans. I go beyond the standard crops of wheat, barley, canola, and peas to include things like potatoes, quinoa, and hemp. And of course, I love taking on cover crops. My expertise is centered around the Canadian prairies. I have a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture with an agronomy focus and a Master's in Science with a focus on plant science. Beyond my formal education, I have attained and maintained my Certified Crop Advisor designation and am a member in good standing with the Alberta Institute of Agrologists. I use Anchor from Spotify to send this podcast out to the world across many platforms, and it tells me I have listeners from every continent. Oddly, it even says I have listeners from Antarctica. If that is you, I would love to hear from you, or wherever you are in the world. Send me an email or connect on Twitter or LinkedIn. If you use Anchor or Spotify, you can leave me a voice message. See you next time.